And now, with Sound Investing, here's Paul Merriman.
I want to take a second just to thank all of you who have written to us over the past months, and not just to me, but to Chris and Daryl and Rich and Aisha and Margie and Barry, all the folks that are working hard to provide you with some information that we hope improves your financial future. I shared in a newsletter this week a bunch of feedback from high school students. And there are times when I'm teaching, I can't tell whether the information is getting through. And I feel that same way about the podcasts and the articles. I don't know whether the information is making an impact until I hear from you. And as you may have seen in the newsletter, or you will see if you haven't gotten that newsletter yet, these kids said some very interesting things about what they learned and what got them excited and what made them look at investing in a new way. And yet, without that letter, I would not have known that. So I just want you to know, I really do appreciate the feedback. And I do really feel upset when I get behind on responding to all of the questions that come in. So I'm going to address some of those questions today. I'm going to make some comments about maybe about the market in general and about stockbrokers. Let me start, as a matter of fact, with stockbrokers. I have, from time to time, have had emails, messages from listeners and readers who feel that I am unfair and that I shouldn't be speaking badly about stockbrokers, because those brokers are the friends of many of you. I know that. And yet it's an interesting position that I'm in. I am not an investment advisor. I am not trying to get you to become a client of mine. Now, I am trying to get you to believe some of the same things that I believe in, because I believe that those things are in your best interest. But what is so different about what I'm doing is I am trying my best, whether it's to a high school student, a college student, or somebody about to retire or in retirement, I am trying to look at the probabilities of decisions that you are making and trying to get you to move to whatever has the highest probability of success. So when we address the very simple decisions about whether you invest in stocks versus bonds for the long term, whether you invest in a mutual fund or individual securities for the long term, whether you invest in mutual funds that either have a load or they have high expenses or they have high turnover for the long term versus the things that would probably be better in terms of what's in your best interest. We know that the benchmarks are very difficult to beat, so therefore the indexes are hard to beat, because those indexes are built to replicate the benchmarks themselves. And so when we see that over 15 years, which is a very short period of time for a lot of people who are following our work, but over 15 years, less than 10% of actively managed funds are able to do better than the benchmarks, I'm thinking with high confidence that investing in those index funds is probably better than trying to pick the ones that are going to end up in that top 10%. I could be super wealthy if I knew how to pick the funds that would outproduce the indexes, because it's obvious that there's a lot of money there to be managed if a person knew how to do that. So it's all about probabilities. And any time somebody says they're thinking about doing X, I'm wondering what the implications are of choosing Y instead. So when you are critical, and I certainly understand this, I don't like people who gossip and who say mean and bad things about others. I'm not comfortable with that. But when I'm talking about the decision to either work with somebody who, let's say, has a commission involved in the process, somebody who happens to be in the business of recommending mutual funds that have higher expenses, that have more turnover, that are actively managed instead of indexes, then I'm thinking the probabilities are better, more in your favor, if you were choosing the index approach, the low expenses, the low turnover, the higher tax efficiency. It's not about the brokers being bad people. In fact, the brokers are just human. It's interesting. I saw an article, I've got a copy of it here, from Morningstar. Actually, the article I read is from Investment News, and the headline, the title, Morningstar, Department of Labor fiduciary rule reduces inflows to mutual funds with high loads. And here's what they're referring to. A few years ago, the Labor Department was going to apply a fiduciary requirement to the recommendations that come out of the financial business. Now, investment advisors already have a fiduciary requirement, but commission-based brokers do not, and or have not. But there was a move to require that prior to Trump being elected, and probably had Clinton been elected, that would have happened. We would have had a fiduciary responsibility for all folks who are giving investment advice, as I think it should be. But for all sorts of reasons, it didn't happen. It died in court, if you want to say it that way. And what happened after? Let's talk about what happened before it died. Brokers were starting to act more like fiduciaries. They stopped selling, not totally, but mostly stopped selling indexed annuities. They started selling more and more low-cost mutual funds, no-load mutual funds on top of that. They started moving to a different way of building their book of business. And it appeared as if this is what was going to happen to the whole industry. And then when it died in court, when the Department of Labor, that was canceled, the move towards the fiduciary responsibilities of all of these folks in the industry that are giving long-term advice, people started to sell indexed annuities again. Sales picked up. We don't have to act in the best interest of the client. Come on, let's get going. I can just hear the sales meetings going on, encouraging people to sell those products that most of us in the business don't believe are in your best interest. So I'm thinking that one of the huge advantages of an index fund, if that's the route you learn to take in making your long-term investments, it suggests that you are not even going to be open to an idea of investing in something that has a commission. Owning and committing your portfolio to indexes, it isn't just that it makes you more money. It is that it saves you money. I was thinking this morning, Warren Buffett versus John Bogle. Who really should be put at the top of the return tree in terms of who's made the most money for you and your friends and your family? Well, it's not Warren Buffett. Warren Buffett has made a lot of money for a relatively small group of people. But John Bogle and Vanguard have made billions and billions, and eventually it will be trillions, by offering investors very low expenses. And as most of you probably already know, the expenses just went down again. Vanguard just recently announced that they are reducing the minimum investment to get into the Admiral shares from $10,000 down to $3,000. And so I think that is going to cut the expenses for many investors by as much as a half of what they've been paying at Vanguard, because they didn't have enough to be in the Admiral shares. So every time I can find a way to help you spend less to get whatever it is you're likely to get in the long term, I want you to know about it, and I'm hoping you'll move toward it and leave more money in your pocket. There's a quote from John Bogle. I think it goes something like, with investing, we get what we, not what we pay for, we get what we don't pay for. And the less that you pay for, the more that you get. Now, I also understand that some people are going to go to Vanguard and they're going to pay Vanguard a fee, even though Vanguard will tell you what funds they're going to put you into so you could do it yourself. They're more than happy to tell you that, particularly if you have $50,000 or more dollars. But lots of people, tens of hundreds of thousands of people, are paying them a fee to do it for them. So I understand that, and I'm not saying that that's money wasted, but I am saying that unless you need somebody to maintain that for you, then you could save more money and therefore make more money. So yes, big deal. Vanguard drops their fees in essence. And we know that Fidelity now has some index funds that are totally free of any administrative costs. All of this is a benefit to investors. So maybe in the end, it turns out that even Fidelity will make more money than Buffett for investors. By the way, I think it's worth mentioning that these reduction in minimums and therefore lower fees for a lot of folks, this is impacting some 38 different funds at Vanguard. So this is a big deal. For example, with the investor shares, that's the one where you before were paying, I think, 14 basis points for the S&P 500. Now, because with $3,000, you qualify for the Admiral shares, you're going to get that same fund managed for 0.04%, which means they have just reduced the fee by about 2/3. So this is a big deal over a lifetime, and we'll be talking about that. What does that extra 0.1% mean to you? Now I want to take on a couple questions, and these questions, maybe three of them, have something in common. And it's interesting that all of a sudden I'm getting a lot of these questions, because they have to do with how much should I have in equities. Now, I think I've been fairly clear about that in the past, but I think what is causing this question to be asked more often is this volatile market with a lot of downside activity in the market is alerting people to the potential downside risk of the market. And what do you do to respond to that? Well, one thing maybe is you reconsider how much you have in equities, because even though people don't like the fact that bonds go down a little bit from time to time, stocks can go down a lot. So I'm going to address that question, and let me start with, I don't know how old this person is, but he is he's asking about the two funds for life strategy, and he wants to know if he buys a target date fund, invests in a target date fund that is built for 2045 retirement, how much should he have in small cap value? Well, that's not exactly what it is that the formula is looking for, but let me tell you how you get to how much you should have in small cap value. Whatever your age, and by the way, you could be 25 and want to retire in 2045. You could be 35 and want to retire in 2045. So the formula for determining how much in small cap value is to multiply your age by 1.5, and I don't know how old this person is, and that is the amount that you would put into the target date fund, and the balance would be in small cap value. Now, I don't mean to confuse the issue here, but it doesn't have to be small cap value. You could be more conservative and put it in small cap blend. You could even be more conservative and put it in large cap value. Or you could split the difference and put half of the value portion in small cap and half in large cap value. And we've shown in our studies that you can find at twofundsforlife.com, we've shown the long-term return, comparative returns, for these different combinations with the target date fund. But if we assume that this person who wants to retire in 2045 is about 38 years old, then that would mean that we multiply 38 by 1.5, that makes 57. So 57% would be, at this point, in the target date fund in 2045. And the other 43% would be in small cap value. Why would somebody, two different age people, be retiring in the same year? Well, maybe one is retiring when they're very young, and one was actually retiring later in life. Or maybe it's somebody who is choosing the 2045 because it has an amount of fixed income in the portfolio to address their personal risk tolerance. So there are all sorts of different ways how people can use these target date funds. And here's another person who wants to know about how much they should have in equities. In this particular case, this gentleman says if he'd like me to address this particular topic. He said, what about those of us who are between 55 and 65 and we have some money we're not going to need in retirement? How much of that money should be in equities? Well, in a sense, it's the same list of questions that I would have for somebody, whether they need the money for retirement or don't need the money for retirement. It always is a question, what's the money for? Ah, you want it to go to your children. You want it to go to charities. You want it to go to children who are in their 20s. If you have children in your 20s and you're 55 to 65, then you could invest that money with their risk tolerance and not yours. That's possible. On the other hand, if that's going to make you nervous and that would be too aggressive, then you invest the money with whatever your risk tolerance might be. So I don't know that it makes any difference whether you're going to need it or not going to need it. If in fact you have low risk tolerance, and when the market's going down and you've got too much money in stocks, you get nervous and want to jump ship, then it doesn't matter that it's there for the long term. If it's going to make you nervous and you do things, you're going to be sorry that you did. I've talked about how my wife and I, how we Now, we have our money invested, and the majority of it, 90% of it, is invested to be have the risk exposure of a 50-50 stocks and bonds. And I'm 75, and she's about 4 years younger. And a lot of people our age would have more than that, and a lot of people would have less than that, normally having to do with their beliefs. In fact, I got an email from a gentleman in his 80s who said, "Why do you recommend people put money into bonds? Bonds are losers." And I don't have any problem with that. And if you read this fellow's email further, you'll find out that he has way more money than he needs, at least that from my viewpoint, he does. And so, yes, he can take the risk of 100% stocks if he wants to, but I would be uncomfortable because I still wrestle with the catastrophic event that could happen that it would have the market down 80 or 70%. That's not like it would be unheard of. That type of decline happens from time to time, less likely in the S&P 500 than the NASDAQ or the small cap index, but still even possible for the S&P 500. So my limitations are not because of how much money I have. It's because I don't want to live through a decline like that and have half of my money in equities. So it's a very personal decision. And there's a free article that's available. Actually, it's a chapter of my book. It's chapter 10 in Financial Fitness Forever. And if you go to paulmerriman.com and you scroll down to the bottom of that home page, you can link through to that free chapter. But basically, what that chapter walks you through are all the questions about your assumptions of how and why your money is being invested. And if you work your way through that, you may find that the percent you should have in equities and bonds will kind of wash out once you look at the relationship with all those different questions that are posed in that free chapter. And by the way, this fellow's question about what to do with money you don't need when you're between 55 and 65, well, it's not so different from the people who will say, I have to take minimum required distributions, and I don't need the money, how should I invest it? It's the same conversation over and over. It's about your risk tolerance. It's about who the money eventually is going to be spent by. It's about how your spouse feels about it, by the way. Just because you have huge risk tolerance levels doesn't mean the better half doesn't have a lower risk tolerance, and that spouse may not be complaining about losses until the market is down 50%. And then they start saying, "You did what to our life savings?" All those things are certainly considerations. And then another question here about that commitment to equities comes from a young fellow, 25 years old. He read First Time Investor, Grow and Protect Your Money, and he said, "I thought it was a fantastic overview. It provided a good understanding of index funds and the asset classes you recommend. It all makes a lot of sense to me." Boy, that is music to my ears. But he's paid off all of his debts, and now he's got $5,000 to put away for the long term in a tax-free savings account. I'm sure he's talking about a Roth IRA here. And he says, "I am just beginning to get into investing and want to understand more before making any moves. It seems with my age, it would be best to go 100% equity into all small cap value." Then in parens, "International, U.S., and emerging markets." Close parens. "Is this a stupid risk to take at my age?" And then he's kind enough to say, I know you can't predict the future. Ha, ha, he says. Well, Brenda, thank you for that email. And again, if I sat down with you one-on-one to understand what you do know about investing, to make sure that this money that you're putting aside for the long term is going to be the long term and not something that you're going to be thinking about using to go back to college, to make a down payment on a house in the next couple of years. All of those kinds of questions have to be addressed. But then I think it's not just a matter of saying that it's appropriate or not to put all that money in small cap value, because beyond just what should you do today, I would like every young person to have a lifetime discipline of how they're going to approach the move from aggressive to more conservative. In your case, Brandon, if you're talking about being all small cap value, I'm guessing that you're likely to be transitioning from all small cap value to some percentage of small cap value and large cap value. And then you'll be transitioning to some percentage of small cap value, large cap value, and blend, which will include then some growth in your portfolio. And at some point, you're likely to not only move from small to large value and from small and large value to blend, you're also going to start adding bonds for the fixed income portion. Now, you probably don't know what glide path to use at 25, but here's what you could consider. You could look at what Vanguard has adopted as their glide path, and you could say, you know, that's an interesting glide path, but I noticed they have 10% in bonds at age 25, and I don't want to do that. So I'm going to overrule their decision to be all 10% in bonds until they start to add more, which turns out at age 40, they start adding more bonds. So maybe what you'd do, Brandon, is you would decide to start adding bonds at age 40. And you might figure out between age 40 and 65 how you're going to end up with a 50-50 stock bond portfolio, 60-40 stock bond portfolio. That would all be part of that glide path. So thinking in terms of the glide path, it isn't just when you will start with the small cap value. And I think that's great. You're considering doing it both U.S., international, and emerging markets. But when to start then adding the other equity asset classes. And I would think that if you looked at the strategy that Chris Pederson has put together on our website, there is, in fact, I'll include a link along with this podcast to the tables that show exactly at what ages, if you want to be aggressive, that you would start adding those other equity asset classes. So you check that out and then see how you feel about starting out with an all small cap value portfolio. See if the changes are going to come at a time in your life that seem to make sense, because eventually you're going to start cooling your jets, Brandon. That's what happens to almost all of us. An old friend of ours, affectionately known as the Mutual Fund Geek, gave me a question to chew on. And it's been a while since he's posed a question, so this is kind of fun to be tested again. But this time, it's about rather than how much in equities and how much in fixed income. It's a different kind of question, but it's the same kind of process of figuring out the right answer. And that is, what is the best strategy for taking money out of investments in retirement? 3%? 4%? What makes sense? And he sent me a couple of links to different articles, and I'm going to include these links as well, because I think that you will enjoy these two articles. One is from AAII, and the other, and I'm embarrassed, I don't remember whether it was Morningstar, but it was another good, solid source. But this decision about what should we use as our glide path, it's another glide path, but it's our distribution glide path. Now, before I get into what I would want the mutual fund geek to be thinking about, again, I want to share what my wife and I have worked through. Because I believe from my memory of the old mutual fund geek that he's oversaved. He's in good shape. But what my wife and I did, we purposefully didn't retire and quit making money and except for Social Security and money that comes out of IRAs and taxable investments. That's the only income we have. I don't work for money anymore. And as many of you have heard me say before, that was one of the promises I made to my wife when I stopped working was no more Mr. Capitalist. From now on, I'm just a teacher. So we decided, since we had oversaved, to be more aggressive and not take 3 or 4%. Could we do okay on 3 or 4%? Yes. Could we give away a third of what we take out of our investments in retirement? No, we would not be able to. But we went to a 5% distribution, and it allows us to give away the amount that we'd like to, travel the amount that we'd like to, buy presents for the kids that we'd like to, all the things that allow us to have a comfortable life. She has a number of times suggested that I get a Tesla. I drive one of those gas eaters. And she would like me to be more environmentally aware. And I cannot picture myself spending the money for a Tesla. Even though maybe I could afford it, maybe I'd have to give away less to be able to afford the Tesla. But the fact is, it's just outside of my comfort zone. And so so deciding how much we're going to take to spend, a lot of it has to do with our personal belief systems. So oversave, and it's pretty easy to be able to take out 5% a year. Now, I know the mutual fund geek knows that we have dozens, I mean dozens of tables that show different combinations of equities and fixed income. In some cases, the equities are all value. Other cases, the equities are a blend of big, small, value, growth, U.S. and international. In another series, the portfolio is all S&P 500, the equity portion. But in each case, with every equity asset class, we show the impact of distributions with 10% in equities, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, all the way up to 100% equity, with the balance being in bonds, so that you can see the implications of having not only different amounts of equity and fixed income, and different equity portfolios, because certainly there's a big difference between the S&P 500 and an all-value portfolio. But we also show distributions on a fixed basis with inflation adjustments every year from 1970 through 2017, taking out 3% to begin with, and 4, and 5, and 6. So you can see the implications, different amounts of equity, different equity asset classes, and different amounts of distributions. All of these forces kind of fighting against each other, but hopefully help you decide where you are going to fit in terms of how much you are going to spend. Now, the other thing is, you could, and a lot of planners, I'm sure, will do this with their clients. They'll build a curve, a bell curve here, that shows how in the early years, it's an inverted bell, in the early years you spend a lot of money. This is early years of retirement. And then you get to a point where you kind of level off, and then as you get older and older, you start having medical costs and care start becoming higher and higher. And so it isn't a straight line, if you will. Now, what my wife and I have done is we've just assumed, hey, we're either going to spend it or we're going to give it away when we take out that 5% every year. And so for us, we see it actually being a relatively straight line, hopefully getting bigger every year if the market would just go up every year. But obviously, that doesn't always happen. Now, what the mutual fund geek pointed out was a strategy of using your minimum required distribution, because you see the government and actuaries have done the actuarial studies to figure out how much, if you're going to run out of money, and let's say at 110 years of age, how much do you take out when you're 65 and 66? And of course, obviously, the older you get, the faster you would take the money out, because you're planning to work it down to zero, I think, if you live to be 110 years old. Well, that's not my plan. And I kind of doubt that that's the mutual fund geek's plan either. But is that an interesting idea, approach to figuring out how much you take out? Because the theory is, if you can live within those constraints and looking at that table, and you'll see that when you look at one of these links that we'll have, you'll see how much you would be taking out as you get older and older, and you could think how you would like to live life with that as your formula. Well, I kind of want to spend more or give it away earlier rather than later. So that would not be one that I would choose, but it is one that is, in essence, time-tested. Now, remember, they're figuring some people will live to be over 100. I am not planning to be part of that group. So I would probably be comfortable being aggressive with my distributions and spending until I'm probably 90. But, there are people who look. In fact, we just had a wonderful lunch yesterday with some friends who are vegetarians. They're both thin and healthy, and I'm just guessing they're going to live longer than I am. And that's a consideration as well. Now, I have left the most difficult conversation to last. And it is truly difficult, because I want to talk about a donate button that is now on our site. When I started the foundation, and actually we started working on it in early 2012, Asia and Margie and Barry, and Rich Buck, we were working on some free books, some free e-books. And the three that you can get at paulmerriman.com, the three are 101 Investment Decisions Guaranteed to Change Your Financial Future. The second is First Time Investor, Grow and Protect Your Money. And the third is Get Smart or Get Screwed, How to Select the Best and Get the Most from Your Investment Advisor. We produced those three books early in 2012, before the foundation was established. The foundation was not established till the very end of 2012, that reason it wasn't established till then was because that's when my old firm was sold, and I was truly retired, and it was at that point, right at the end of 2012, that I made a lump sum contribution to start the foundation. At the same time, I set it up because my hope is this foundation will survive long past my life. I set it up so that at my death, the foundation will receive all the proceeds of my IRA, as well as some other investments that I don't think the family needs. And I hope they agree. And so I thought I was going to carry whatever the financial load would be, and that I wouldn't have to ask or need to ask money from others. And I probably don't need to, but many people have asked if they can donate money to the foundation. But let me tell you what's changed from the beginning. In 2012, I made arrangements to started negotiating with Western Washington University to, in essence, underwrite the course Personal Investing 216. They house teach about 50 students, 45 to 50 students a quarter, and I'm thrilled to have been responsible for helping that get started. But what's happened since is we're now in negotiation. When I say negotiation, we're working out a financial relationship where the foundation will be not just supporting that class, but also building. We're in the initial stages of testing a educational process that will impact not just 45 to 50 students a quarter, but every student who comes through Western will be exposed to some financial literacy and training in their freshman, sophomore, junior, and senior year. All students. Thrilling to me. Absolutely thrilling. So that is a big project and is going to require more money than I have at this present time. Also, I have decided to turn up the heat in terms of commitment to spending money on training young people. We are working now on some ways of educating young people that are it's going to cost some money, but I think we will find ways to use very modern, effective technology, combining very short videos that are made with cartoons or whiteboard kinds of presentations that are very short, so that in a series of short videos, they would understand no-load funds, they'd understand mutual funds, they'd understand low expenses. They would learn as quickly and as efficiently as possible how important these decisions are to their financial future. That, too, is going to cost some money. I continue to work without any compensation and will as long as I'm around. But we have others who are working without compensation, but then we have others that this is partly how they make their living. And certainly the team of people, Aisha Griffin and Margie Baxley and Barry is out of Guadalajara in Mexico, and Margie's out of South Carolina. And right now, Aisha is somewhere in Spain. And enjoying life and doing some great work getting information out to all of you. So we do have an overhead to run the operation, even though we have a lot of time that's being donated to the cause. So, yes, you can now donate. And, yes, it is tax deductible because we are 501c3. We are a private operating foundation, a private operating foundation, and so any contributions are tax deductible. And I will continue each year to make what to me is a major contribution to keep this thing going and growing. And if you want to help in that process, I appreciate that, and I promise that the money will not be wasted. We will work hard, and I think it's fair to say that probably in terms of spending money, probably 80%+ is going to go on the work that we do for young adults, all the way from high school to college, and then to first-time investors in 401k plans. We want to do a lot of work there, and I think, again, this whiteboard educational process will be very effective. So thanks to those of you who prodded me and got me going on this, and we will, I think, once we start doing this with the public, we have to every year put out a financial statement or something. We'll do all of that to make sure that we are legal. So thank you for listening, as always, and hope you had a great Thanksgiving. Boy, we sure did, and we're ready to go with the holidays. So we'll be talking with you soon. Thanks for listening. Bye.
That was Paul Merriman with Sound Investing. Sound Investing, soundinvesting.com, and paulmerriman.com are produced and exclusively owned by Paul Merriman, who is solely responsible for their content. For more information, free articles, mutual fund recommendations, and more, visit paulmerriman.com.